Lecture 18, Feminism Concluded.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the third and last of our lectures on feminism. Let me just remind you of what's gone before. In the first of these three lectures, I introduced feminist ideas by way of discussing John Stuart Mill's liberal feminism and Betty Friedan's reactions to a situation in which just about all of what Mill had been looking for by way of institutional changes had in fact taken place. In the second of the lectures, I discussed later developments within liberal feminism, including the development of arguments for affirmative action, and also the way in which feminism raised wider questions about liberalism and other mainstream ideas. I also briefly discussed socialist feminism and 1970s radical feminism. In this lecture, I'm going to discuss three things. First of all, an interesting development within feminism, which in part is a reaction to the other feminist ideas that we've looked at. Second, I'm going to discuss some other strands within recent feminism, which are interesting, but a bit abstruse. I'm going to discuss them very briefly. In the last part of the lecture, I'm going to discuss some reactions to feminism made by liberals and conservatives. First, then, I want to talk about the development within feminism to which I referred before, a development which stresses the theme of difference. What's this all about? Well, much within both liberal and radical feminism, from Mill to Millet, as it were, is actually critical of feminine characteristics as they currently exist. You may recall the way in which things which are, as it were, distinctive of women in our experience are treated as the products of education for subservience. And there was also this material about sex and gender, which seemed to suggest that these things were social products and open to change, but in which also many things which you could traditionally associate with women were, in a sense, being dumped on. There is, however, also a tradition within feminism of esteem for what was taken to be distinctive to women. For example, people in this context emphasized pacifism and the role that women had played in kind of crusades against war. They'd stressed the temperance movement and the role that women had had in this context. And in addition, there was often stress placed on women as caring, both for kids, but just more generally. And indeed, these ideas have more recently been built on and developed with a stress being placed upon their cultural character, as opposed to it being claimed that these things are, in some sense, biologically necessary or biologically essential to women. These ideas are quite often referred to as difference feminism. Concern, however, has sometimes been expressed about this development by liberal, socialist, and radical feminists. Why? Well, because in their view, what was being praised, singled out for attention in women, was, on the basis of their different analyses, typically the product of, or formed a basis for, the domination of women by men. And so this movement was important, but there was also some suspicion shown of it. Let me introduce this by way of a much-discussed example. It relates to the work of a psychologist called Carol Gilligan, who in 1982 published a book called In a Different Voice. In order to understand her work, you need to understand a bit of the theoretical background against which she was writing. At that time, a distinguished psychologist called Lawrence Kohlberg had written a good deal about human moral development. And he had argued that this typically runs through certain different stages up to human maturity. You could compare this to the work, say, of the psychologist Piaget, who wanted to argue that children's understanding of the world typically develops through certain kinds of stages, so that, for example, at the end of the day, their awareness of the continuity of objects is what we normally now experience as adults, but that in earlier stages, this is incomplete. Indeed, a friend of mine who is well aware of this work at one point got very fed up with some friends of his who'd got young kids who they were praising to the skies. And he made use of his knowledge of Piaget to kind of show the kids up, I mean, basically by hiding a candy under a cushion and then taking the cushion off, and the kid went to get the candy from under it. And then he hid another one, knowing that at the kind of age where the kids were, they didn't have a strong sense of the continuity of objects, and that, much to the chagrin of the parents, the kids went and looked in the same place under the first cushion for where the candy had been hidden rather than where it had been hidden the second time. And the parents thought that this was just showing up their kids as being dumb, but actually it's a fairly standard reaction at a certain time. Now, just as Piaget had argued that there are these stages in kids' cognitive development, Kohlberg had argued that there are stages in moral development leading up to a situation where people's moral judgments are made on the basis of universal principles. And what he'd argued that is that women are often found to be morally underdeveloped because their moral judgments didn't have this kind of abstract character that he wanted to associate with someone who was fully morally developed. Gilligan, by way of contrast, argued that there are, in fact, two different moral voices which are equally valid. One of them involving justice, rights, and abstractions, the other centered around caring, responsibilities, and particular concrete relationships. She argued that the second of these moral voices was often used by women. Gilligan's thesis was presented by some other people in a slightly vulgarized way as simply saying that there is a contrast between men using abstractions and women having this caring, concrete stuff. Gilligan's work has been interesting, but it's given rise to a whole complex literature. For example, there has been argument as to whether Gilligan is or isn't correct about the differences that she claims to exist. If she is right about them, one might ask, what is one to make of them? In addition, if there are these differences, how might they relate to ideas in moral philosophy about what are the appropriate ideas for us to have? It's kind of interesting, actually, that in connection with our discussion of socialism, I referred briefly to the theme of virtue ethics. And some people have noted that there's some relationships between Gilligan's ideas and the kind of things that people appeal to in that context. So the whole argument gets into a lot of interesting theoretical material. You may think, fine for the theorists, but surely this stuff has nothing to do with the real world. Well, actually, no, because an interesting twist was given to all of this in a court case in the US, often referred to as the Sears case. It involved Sears Roebuck, the big chain of department stores. What had happened was that the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission had taken Sears to court, alleging so-called statistical discrimination against women employees. It wasn't being claimed that they discriminated against particular individuals, but they were claiming that relatively few women figured amongst their high-paid commission-only salespeople. Namely, some people, as I understand it, are paid a regular wage and then are paid a certain commission on what they sell. There are other people, and these are often going to be the big hitters in sales, who basically don't get a regular salary. They're simply paid on commission. And these people, in a sense, are putting their life on the edge, but they've got sufficient confidence in their own judgment to be able to bring in a whole lot of money that way. Now, what happened in this context was that when the case came to court, Sears called on a woman historian to give evidence as part of their case. And what she did was to argue that men and women had different preferences with regard to employment. And she referred, in the course of this, to Gilligan's work. And what she basically did was to say, look, women's values, I want to argue, are typically rather different from those of men. And rather than see as discriminating against women, what it was doing was instead respecting their preferences. But typically, their women employees or associates would also testify were people who didn't want these really risky jobs. They preferred a good measure of stability and also a job which, in a sense, allowed them to split their commitments between home concerns and their employment. This, as one can imagine, led to some fascinating arguments, not least between feminists. Because liberal feminists, some socialist feminists and radical feminists said, indeed, yes, in a sense, this is just what we were suspecting, that difference feminism in this line of argument might sometimes be used as a weapon against women and their interests. It's also worth noting, and things here get a bit complex, that there has been another kind of argument about difference taking place within feminism. What's happened here is that modern liberal and radical feminism have been criticized because, their critics say, within feminism, they've been concerned largely with the interests of white, middle-class women in Western countries. What has been said is, look, the kind of concerns that they have been expressing, the kind of issues they brought forward, are fine for that group, but they haven't actually fitted the needs and concerns, for example, of African-American women, or, for example, women in third world countries. And so it's been argued both about such women, but also in some cases by people who themselves fall into those groups, that there has been something wrong with feminism as it has developed. So much, because my time is limited, for difference feminism. Let me now move on to the next theme, namely recent theoretical developments within feminism. What I've talked about so far concerning feminism hasn't covered some of the very most recent theoretical work. The reason for this really is the following, that while this work is interesting, some of it is pretty abstruse, and it's not really very easily dealt with without a background in philosophy that I can't really supply just as we're going in the course of these lectures. In the very broadest of terms, this work has been concerned with a number of different themes. First of all, there's been discussion of the way in which women and issues of interest to women have been marginalized in academic work. You may say, well, that's no big deal. But these writers have said, look, often it's from academic work that we take our picture of reality and what's involved in it, and it's then really very serious if there's been a certain kind of systematic bias in terms of the issues that have been studied or the priority that's been given to some things rather than others. A second line of argument has involved critical analysis of what we take for granted as matters of fact. And what's been claimed is that this has often involved reading into the world various culturally variable concepts and theories, for example, in the area of gender, and that this, in their turn, has had important implications in terms of matters to do with power. Let me give you an example from a slightly different field to try and bring this alive. Take the somewhat vexed area of mental illness. How this has been understood historically has been influenced by various different theoretical ideas. For example, at certain points people believed that mental illness was a matter of demonic possession, people being possessed by demons. Indeed, there have been a whole host of different explanatory ideas in this area which have affected how mental illness has been perceived. There have also been very varied ideas as to what counts as mental illness. For example, over a certain period, sexual preferences for members of one's own sex were taken to be a form of mental illness. Clearly, these matters have been very significant because of how they affect how people are treated. I mean, if you're mentally ill, you may well be locked up. And indeed, one can see this kind of role of theoretical ideas as amounting to a justification for certain kinds of exercises of power. Who is treated as eccentric? who is treated as dangerous and so on. It's a matter of different theoretical ideas which serve to empower some people to do things to others. And indeed, some feminists have argued that much the same is true with regard to issues relating to gender. Certain things were judged to be appropriate roles for men and for women. Different ideas were entertained as to how masculinity and femininity should be understood. What was an appropriately masculine attitude? What was a feminine attitude? There were also important tie-ups between notions about femininity and nationalism, you know, the mother country under threat, what was involved in war. I mean, typically women and children as victims to be defended. Also, it raises issues about, for example, whether it's appropriate that women should serve in combat positions in the armed forces. Indeed, all of this has led to a whole lot of very, very interesting work, although I must say that the work isn't always terribly readable. It takes a bit to get into it, and I think at this point what I'm going to have to do is just to call a halt in discussion of this particular material to say, you know, if I've whetted your appetite, go into it further, and instead to discuss something rather different, namely critical reactions to feminism that have come from conservatives and liberals. First of all, by way of introduction, feminist ideas, as we have looked at them, pose, I think, three main challenges to the kind of ideas that I was discussing as the mainstream of political ideas within the US. One strand within feminism might be seen, in effect, as a development of a strong form of welfare liberalism focused upon the interests of women. There's clear continuity between this and welfare liberalism as part of the mainstream. Within this context, women are seen as a disadvantaged group who stand in need of active government assistance in order to promote their autonomy and also in order to promote equal opportunities by way, for example, of programs of affirmative action. There is, I think, room for argument about the extent to which welfare liberalism can accommodate these feminist concerns. I mean, clearly, there is much that the ethos of welfare liberalism allows for, but there are also other elements within this aspect of feminism which take issue with liberal individualism as such, and liberal individualism is involved in welfare liberalism just as it is in classical liberalism. Accordingly, welfare liberals in this area may be able to offer feminists quite a bit, although what they're able to offer may well stop short of what it is that some feminists want. Second, there are the elements within feminism that challenge liberal ideas theoretically. For example, the ones that we met in the second of these lectures on feminism, where we were concerned with problems of liberal feminism. For example, there was this challenge as to whether the individual as depicted by liberalism is really a man, and as to whether autonomy and self-development really should be taken up as ideals for everybody. To these, in more practical terms, as it were, may be added an emphasis on differences between men and women, issues about opposition to pornography, whether pornography can be taken, say, as properly part of the freedom of expression, and also the emphasis, say, that one has had on certain campuses in universities and colleges about the need to develop explicit codes regulating interaction between men and women. Third, there are the aspects within feminism, from liberal feminism to radical feminism, that challenge more traditional views of women's roles and ideals. Ideas which were critical of a life centered around marriage and children, and of traditional conceptions of femininity and of women's sexuality. To these kinds of issues, there have, it seems to me, been four rather interesting different critical reactions. First of all, there they are, the reactions of classical liberals. Classical liberals have typically reacted against the first two strands of this criticism, affirmative action demands and challenges to liberal ideas. I guess, personally, classical liberals may well not sympathize all that much with some older traditional conceptions of what a proper woman's character was and a proper role for women was. But I think their view is, look, these are matters that women should be able to make choices about, and indeed that they should be able to choose more traditional pictures of a woman's role if they so wish. And so classical liberals are typically resistant to the idea that government should be brought in to try and push people in particular directions and to force them to make certain kinds of choices. They also would stress, however, with John Stuart Mill, that there shouldn't be legal barriers to women's activities and careers and so on either. I think they would surely agree that feminists may have raised some interesting problems, for example, about the role of social conventions. But these, I think, are problems that, in their view, individuals basically have to sort out for themselves, either individually, just in terms of particular individuals and their individual struggles, or in voluntary association with one another. They don't really want government involved. They also typically take the view that the kinds of measures that other feminists, for example, those who've integrated their views with welfare liberalism, have canvassed, say about affirmative action, are paternalistic and treat people somewhat misleadingly as members of groups. They stress the individual. Indeed, in their view, such approaches take freedom and responsibility away from the individual where it properly belongs. And they also suggest that those approaches treat women as if they're not capable of making sensible choices for themselves. More generally, classical liberals are skeptical about the results of governmental action, noting that in the past, regulation presented as being in operation for the welfare of women was in fact used as a way to stop women competing against men for certain jobs. As to affirmative action, classical liberals' worries are, I guess, on three main points. First of all, I think their view is it typically operates largely to the advantage of the most advantaged members of the group in question, who typically would pretty well do reasonably if they were left to their own devices. That's to say, who benefits? It's largely the most advantaged members of the group who are being given a helping hand. The people who suffer, by way of contrast, are likely to be the most marginal individuals in the so-called favoured groups. Say, if there is affirmative action for women and, in effect, against men, the men who will suffer will typically be those men who are most marginal. The women who will gain will typically be those women who are in the most socially advantaged positions. In addition, the operation of affirmative action calls into question, they want to claim, whether those who fall into the favoured category have achieved their positions only by virtue of getting special assistance. It risks diminishing their achievement. These are the kind of arguments that they offer. Conservatives have reacted rather differently. First of all, I think that they have typically argued that feminism amounts to the social imposition of a particular and, in their view, pernicious liberal ideal of life for women, drawn, what's more, they'd often say, from some of the less attractive features of men's lives. It's seen as hostile towards families and hostile towards motherhood. And indeed, they would say, oddly, for something that's supposed to be feminist, it's seen as holding up an ideal drawn from men's roles in the workplace and male sexual conduct as what everyone should be following in terms of their behaviour everywhere. There's also often objection to the encouragement of selfishness and to the idea that everyone should be putting their own interests before the good of others. Some conservatives, indeed, address these issues from a religious background and contrast the kind of conduct and way of life that feminism commends with what, in their view, is the right way to act, that which, in their view, has been commanded by God. On some issues, however, there may be agreement with some feminists, for example, in terms of critical attitudes towards pornography, also in some practical measures that seek to look after the interests of women with children, And also they may find that there's a certain kind of overlap between themselves and the attitudes of some of the different feminists. It's also worth noting, however, and this is my third group here, that there are what you can call some conservative feminists. Who are they? Well, they're people who typically sympathize with many of the concerns of feminists, including the feminist critique of liberal individualism. But they in turn are critical of what seems to them to be the anti-man or anti-family aspects of feminism as it's developed. Elizabeth Fox Genovese, an author who's played an important role in this group, sums up this kind of reaction in the title of a book of hers called Feminism is Not the Story of My Life, and that's in quotes. That's to say, her concern is that feminism comes over as anti-children and anti-family and is concerned with the interests of middle-class professionals whose concerns don't mirror those of all and indeed of ordinary women. And indeed, Fox Genovese and other such writers want to modify feminism so that it better addresses what they see as the concerns of ordinary women who may have strong interests in families. There have also, though, been strong defenses of liberalism. Some liberals, welfare liberals and classical liberals, have reacted strongly against those aspects of feminism that are critical of liberalism. In particular, there has been a sharp controversy over the issue of free speech and pornography. Here one finds together, as it were, the libertarian Wendy McElroy and the welfare liberal, the president of the ACLU, the Civil Liberties Union, Nadine Strossen, each of whom see themselves as liberal feminists, taking up arms, as it were, against the radical feminists Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin in their critique of pornography. They, Dworkin and MacKinnon, were willing to ally themselves pragmatically with conservatives to try to limit the sale of pornography, and one had these two sort of staunch liberals crusading against them. Indeed, this particular controversy raises issues about toleration, which we will revisit towards the end of the lectures. Let me now move, in a sense, to sum up over this material relating to feminism. In this lecture and the other lectures on feminism, we've really covered quite a lot of ground. We've seen how feminism is diverse, ranging from those who relate it to classical liberalism, those who relate it to welfare liberalism and to socialism, and also to outlooks that are very radical. Then we've also seen that there are others, for example, the difference feminists and people who are like Fox Genovese, who in a way are somewhat more conservative in their attitudes, all within the broader camp of feminism. This, I think, makes for a lot of controversy and also has generated many interesting perspectives on society and on the issues of how we should see relations between men and women, and more generally, concerning issues relating to gender and the influence of culture on us and how it shapes us more generally. This material has also, however, led to a range of interesting wider challenges, for example, for those whose focus is much more on mainstream issues. For example, if existing social conventions are unfair, how can this be tackled? And indeed, we've touched here on issues that, as we've seen, raise issues about network effects that arose in the context of arguments even about the breakup of Microsoft. We also came in this context on challenging ideas about whether the individual, when this figure is being invoked in political argument, possibly not just refer to men, or treat women who are actually different as if they can be just treated just like men can. Also, can liberal ideas about autonomy and self-development apply equally both to men and women? Should, say, equality between men and women mean that, say, women should equally be involved in combat duties and in the making and consumption of pornography? Is this a matter of women's freedom or a matter, say, of their exploitation? Indeed, one might ask, does feminism itself speak for women, or does it, as its conservative critics argue, involve pressing on women a particular welfare liberal agenda which devalues the choice of a home and a family-centered life? I think whatever else critics might say about feminism, one surely can't say that it doesn't give rise to interesting and challenging questions. Thank you.